Back together, you and I, on Thursday, January 20th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. Connecticut Business and Industry Association VP of Government Affairs Eric Getty joined us again to talk about the financial stability and viability of Connecticut's new paid family and medical leave program. Fairfield GOP State Senator Tony Wong dropped by to discuss the future of Governor Ned Lamont's COVID-related executive orders. And during the show, I felt the need to vent again, this time about some of the lunacy, I think, surrounding the current voting rights debate in Washington. But I got to step in here for a minute and shift gears just for a minute here. You know, I've been poking around. Every break I take on the show, I go back to the computer. I'm scanning for news items, local, national, worldwide, you know, because we're in a show in the afternoon where you know, things are changing, and I try to keep you up to date. Now, you know that I have been, I have shown no hesitancy. And I get criticized for this on the air. I get emails. What's the matter with you? They got to you. Those are the best ones. So your company is telling you what to say on the election thing? No. Nobody in the 30 plus years I've ever been doing shows like this has ever told me not to say something or to say something about anything. But everybody knows that I have been very critical about people, particularly on the right, who still, without any hard substantive evidence that is backed up by quality, notice I said quality legal representation, not crazy lawyers, quality members of the bar in good standing who have reputations and resumes. I have said that I don't believe there was any mass. Were there little hiccups here and there? Of course there are. There are in every election. But there was no mass plan to steal the election. I'm sorry. And I have been quick to chide those on the right who do that. Now, may I add, I'm going to, foster that same criticism to those on the left who are just saying some of the freaking dumbest stuff I have ever heard in my life after this vote yesterday. I mean, you people on the left, you Democrats, you liberals out there who keep saying, oh, the language on the right and this and the other, there's going to be a civil war. And I say, calm down. Yeah, there are idiots. There are idiots on both sides. You know, I get it. But let me tell you something. Your side ain't any better. This is the headline right now. All because the Democrats, who have used the filibuster 600 plus times over the past 12 or 13 years. This is the headline on the Huffington Post, which I know. What are you watching the Huffington Post for? I know. It's like watching kindergarten. I get it, but I have to keep an eye on it. Democracy's doomed Hail Mary. Broken system left to rot. What in the hell are you talking about? What broken system? There is no broken system. The system works fine. It worked fine in November of 2020, and it'll work fine again in November of this year for the elections. And my God, you read some of the idiots on these sites. I'm telling you, you know what? If we could turn off every bit of social media for a month, we would be in such a better position now. I've done shows like this for years without social media. Believe me, I got it done. You can do it. Takes a little more thought, a little more effort, but you can do it. But some of the stuff coming from the left, oh my God. And it's not just fringe sites like this. I mean, some of the stuff you see, granted, on left-leaning channels, I mean, they say the right is crazy. Hey, toots, hey, buddy, you on the left, you're as nuts as the right is sometimes. You're out of your minds. The filibuster was just fine when you people used it. Now, oh, my God, nobody's going to be able to vote because of Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Will you stop it? Shut up. I tell you, I don't know where we're going here. I'm telling you, the 5 or 10% of nuts on the right and the 5% of 10% of nuts on the left all should be dropped in a big barrel and let them go at it. some of this stuff you see on social media that unfortunately soaks into the brains of low information voters. And look, I chide people on the right all the time, and the media does too. You know, some of these idiots, these morons that were at the Capitol on January 6th, what are you doing? What in the hell are you doing? While Trump won and he's being reinstated on this day, what are you talking about? But I'm going to say the same thing for people on the left. And now you have this psychosis sinking in on the left. And what they're saying is just as damn dangerous as it is as to what is said on the right. You want to chide the right for saying Trump legitimately won, which he didn't? Okay, I agree with you. That's dumb talk. But I'm not going to let you get away with saying, oh, democracy is done. Here comes a civil war. They're not going to let you vote. What? Where is your evidence? What are you saying? Do you understand that you're fermenting this paranoia among, let's face it, a lot of people that aren't real intelligent? And there are a lot of people on both sides. See, pre-social media, pre-cable television news cycle, we could say this stuff, and it never went on, it never went beyond the next table when we're in a bar drunk and saying dumb stuff. But now you can infect the entire world with your idiocy. So no, the system is not broken. No, the filibuster is not killing people. No, we're not going back to a civil war. My God, take a breath. Have a tea, will you? Well, as we mentioned, over the past year and change, it actually started about a year ago. The state started to deduct 0.5% from your paycheck to fund a state-level Family and Medical Leave Act that was long time talked about here in Connecticut. It finally got pushed through the General Assembly. And the notion was, well, let's let the money accrue in the account here. We're going to bring in Aflac to run this thing, and everything will be fine. And I had guests on before and during that saying, hey, we have to make sure there's enough money here, because if there isn't, what do you do? Do you charge people more? Do you take more out of the checks? Do you have the general fund filling in? Well, our next guest is VP of Public Policy with the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. And he wrote an op-ed, when was this, last week, the 14th, so 6 days ago, the math doesn't work on paid Connecticut leave. And a lot of people have said that from the beginning. Eric Getty is the guest. Hey, Eric, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you so much for having me on.
Interesting piece, Eric, because all in the run-up to this, everybody I had on said, well, this is fine and dandy and fuzzy and warm as long as the numbers add up. And did we not hear, you probably saw the same announcement I did a couple of weeks ago, okay, people can now apply for this. And to the press's credit, Eric, in Hartford, there were two or three questions. Is there enough money for this? Is the money going to be there? And we got assurances from the woman running the program saying, oh, we're fine. We're fine. Well, you've run some numbers here, and what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, we were certainly a little bit concerned. We were running the numbers when this was still just a proposal in front of the General Assembly all those years ago, and we expressed some real concerns that the 0.5% that's taken from every employee's pay in the state of Connecticut to fund this was not going to be enough money. And, you know, just using the numbers that they cited, you know, let's say an individual, let's say they make $78,000. Well, at 0.5% of that, they're only contributing about $390 into the program every year, but they're eligible to collect more than $9,000, which means for every person who's collecting or who's claiming a benefit from this new program, at that level, you need 24 people paying in. That's a lot of people for every person paying into the program. In fact, they project that 85,000 claims will be had that they'll be dealing with in the next year. That would mean if it's, you know, 24 for every one of those individuals, you need 2 million people paying into the system. But we only have 1.39 million private sector workers in the state of Connecticut. So we're a little concerned. Now, that being said, I will say that Andrea Barton Reeves, the executive director in the Paid Family Medical Authority, they have done an amazing job actually getting this thing off the ground and running. And I truly do believe that they are very concerned about stopping any fraud. And you know, I think they've made a lot of right decisions in the way that they've implemented this using a private sector provider, as you mentioned. So, you know, I hope we're wrong. But again, we are concerned. And you know, that's something that we needed to express.
All right, Eric, hang on. We'll be right back with Eric Getty from the Connecticut Business and Industry Association as we chat about the state's paid family and medical leave program, which was accruing money for a year to get the money in the fund to start seeding it, set up some capital, start building interest. But now, as Eric said, if you look at the numbers, as insurance companies do all the time, what's our risk here? It may be a little testy. More on that first. Traffic and weather together. 3:36 on WICC. And we roll along. Don't forget Governor Ned Lamont coming up live after the news at the top. His latest update on COVID-19 in the state, and every indication is he's going to outline what he wants to do with the executive order. So that's coming up less than 30 minutes away. A few more moments with Eric Getty, VP of Public Policy, the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, on his piece about a week ago. He wrote for Hearst Connecticut Media, "The Math Doesn't Work on Connecticut Paid Leave." So obviously, Eric, the question now, the question begs, as was brought up with folks that I had on before this was passed. Okay, if and when there is a trickle to a flow of red ink on this, does the contribution get raised? Does the state then have to plug the hole here from the general fund in the worst case scenario? That's what everybody may be wondering on this. If, as you say, an overwhelming amount of these claims are approved.
Yeah, well, right now under the law, what is supposed to happen is that the benefit that people receive through the program is supposed to be reduced. Now, the big problem with that is that the General Assembly has never reduced a benefit in its entire history.
No.
So that seems highly unlikely. And what most likely is going to happen is that they're going to start coming to the business community to contribute to this program. And in fact, we had one senator just this weekend on social media suggest in response to my piece, that's not such a bad idea. And I guess that is the real focus of what I was trying to say, is that we have this program. We're a little unsure about whether it's sustainable, but this was just one of 28 new labor mandates placed on the business community by the Labor Committee at the General Assembly in just 4 short years. And if they're all like this, where they're all on a little bit, shaky ground in terms of their fiscal future, that's going to be a lot for the business community to have to incur in terms of additional expenses in a state that's already in the top 5 most expensive states to run a business in the country. So, you know, it's something that we really are concerned about at CBIA.
Yeah, I heard about that Senate member saying, that legislator saying, well, you know, maybe the businesses could contribute. Well, what? That sounds like a line out of The Sopranos, Eric. I mean, we'd like you to, contribute. What does that mean? Does that mean they're looking for checks from businesses? Does that mean they're looking for philanthropy? I mean, that's a little odd, don't you think?
Well, we know exactly what it means. It means additional taxes on the business community. And it's just one more difficult thing that the Connecticut business community has to face. You know, we've got one particular committee at that General Assembly always looking to add new costs onto business. And it's crazy because it seems like so many other lawmakers have seen our national rankings and have taken action so that we improve and we look better as a state to do business. But and you even have a bipartisan group of lawmakers talking about tax cuts this year, which is fantastic news. It's something we should be doing to really jumpstart our economy. But you've got one small group that just, you know, always planning their next new labor mandate on Connecticut businesses, which, of course, is our state's labor committee.
And, Eric, as we head now into an election year for the state House, the state Senate, and the, obviously, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the constitutional offices, you know, generally, as you and I have followed the General Assembly over the years, you know, this is the year where it's the, you know, don't do anything to harm our political standing year, you know, the even numbered years versus, you know, the odd number years. Any vibes you folks, you or you folks at CBIA are getting about this, you know, rematch now with Bob Stefanowski and Ned Lamond round two? It certainly should be interesting.
You know, I'm not a politics guy. I'm a policy guy. So I don't even know yet, you know, who's going to come out and who's going to be, you know, running it against who at the end of the day. But I can tell you this, that this is probably the most important General Assembly session that we've had in the history, at least that I've been up at the General Assembly, which is a long time now. You know, we have a point where we've made some bipartisan changes just a few years ago that has put us in a temporarily pretty darn good fiscal condition. And we have the opportunity to enact policy, tax policy, other policies in the state that really could jumpstart our economy and put us in a position for some significant growth. We just cannot waste it. And it's this year that's really going to determine that. So I'm so focused on, you know, making good policy for the business community and for the rest of Connecticut at the General Assembly this year to worry about elections in November.
All right. Eric Getty has been the guest. Eric, thank you. We appreciate the time. Folks, check out his op-ed regarding the paid family and medical leave plan. We'll see how that shakes out. Eric Getty, once again, the guest with us for this segment. He's VP of Public Policy with the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. Eric, thanks. Be good. And I'm sure we'll talk during the election cycle. Thank you, sir.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Governor Ned Lamond said he wants his executive orders, his last 11 executive orders, he wants them to end on February 15th, quote, unless the legislature acts, unquote, I believe is what he said today. What does that mean? Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield, maybe he can answer this. Tony, good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. I was just laughing so hard listening to you and Melissa shake it off, check it off.
Yeah. God, I still can't get over the whack in the ankles with the nudge.
Well, you know Melissa is the
lover. It was
a
different time,
she is
yeah.
Just so,
I know.
So endearing. Oh. She makes such an impression on you. But I'm just going to have to remember, Melissa, shake it off.
There it is. Tony, what... I heard the governor today, and we aired his, you know, news conference as we do here as a public service. He said he wants everything to end, Tony, unless the legislature acts. What does he mean by that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there was a whisper campaign weeks ago about him extending for the seventh time the executive emergency power, which kind of gives him the ability to make laws in very quick notice, and that was his rationale during an emergency. And what he got, I believe, was a lukewarm response from both Democrats and Republicans. And I truly believe that were he to ask for a full extension of his powers for a seventh time, I truly believe he wouldn't have had the votes to extend it. And so now we're at the position where he says, look, I'm going to have 11 executive orders. I don't know if it's the last 11, but he's going to selectively choose 11 of his executive orders and ask for the legislature to vote on them. I know one of them he pointed out was the school mandate masks.
Okay.
And there are a number of other issues. And on your show, you raised the question, Paul, that one of the reasons that the Democratic majority legislatures in the House and the Senate as legislatures were more than willing to grant the governor this universal emergency power was so they wouldn't have to vote on these very difficult decisions.
Coming into an election year, yeah.
Election year where they're going to have to face the music of people who said, why did you vote this way versus the other? And I think that's an important factor, perhaps, what the governor said, because guess what? Legislative bodies haven't had to make hard votes.
Mm.
in these kind of emergency decisions that have created so much emotion and frustration. And look, it's easy to blame him when he has all the power, but it's equally frustrating because he's in a vacuum and he's not listening to the people whose laws are impacting and making a difference on. So for me, I can only speak for me. I'll vote on all 11 of those cases, make the necessary decisions because that's what we're elected to do. But there may be people who say, oh, wait a second, I don't want to have to make this tough vote and have to face the music.
And so, Tony, do you have, beyond the mask thing that he alluded to, is there any buzz as to what the other 10 might be? I know that his legal counsel, Nora Danahy, is supposedly drafting these. Has the caucus heard anything about the other 10?
No, I'll be honest with you. They had a leadership meeting yesterday. I believe they're going to talk some more. But listen, I think he had over, and I could be corrected, I think he had over like 75, if not more, executive orders. Some have expired. Some were very, very, very effective. I'll give you a recent one that he issued an executive order that allowed our retired teachers to get back into teaching without some of the legislative requirements and restrictions. I thought that was a good one to ensure teacher shortages issues be addressed. But another one that I thought he handled in a vacuum was very poorly managed was allowing COVID-positive patients from hospitals to be admitted into our nursing homes in long-term care. And there was some kind of reaction after he made that executive order. But recently just made another one that said, oh, for anybody visiting our nursing homes now need to be vaccinated show proof of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're admitting COVID-positive patients into the nursing homes while you're restricting people coming in and out. My biggest frustration with this governor and the executive powers that he's had is a inconsistency in his application, right? He can force a mandate on our schools, but he will not force a mask mandate on the general public. Instead, he delegated it and put that onus on our local municipalities who's had to deal with the inconsistency in policies. We've got challenges in regards to masks indoors and out, restaurants, and the kind of increase in the pandemic and the dangers of it. And another breath, I hear we're spending $5-6 million on a tourism board welcoming people to come and visit Connecticut. So for me, it's a inconsistency because decisions are made in a vacuum that does not reflect all the people who are affected by it. And that's frustrating. And you hear that from people after nearly 2 years.
What happens?
I don't believe he would have gotten that extension.
Yeah, Tony, finally, what happens if he... Now, look, he's obviously, I guess, talked this over with the leaders from his party, but what would happen, and I don't know if this is possible, if he says, well, I have 11 orders here that you can vote on. What if the majority party says we want nothing to do with this? Then what happens?
Well, I think he's pushed the pressure on them that he's going to give you 11 bills to vote on, and they're going to have to vote on it. And that's a way for him to say, look, I'm not taking a hit anymore, you know?
In an election year, Tony, he's like, hey, I got something coming up in November. You people have to do something now.
Exactly. And look, people behave differently. I wish they were behaving that way in an off-election year when they make policies that we now have to live with, and they're hopeful that people have short memories. But the challenge of the dynamic is, okay, we'll vote on those 11, Paul. But the tougher question, policy question, is what happens after the 11 issues going forward?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have a normal legislative policy where he's going to have to go through the legislature and we're going to have public hearings with people testifying that laws are being made where we have to listen to the people who have to live with them? Or how are we going to move forward, right? He hasn't answered that question. And the selective executive power, what's he looking for? Is he saying that the next surge or the next change that happens.
This is all going to be very interesting. This will be a teachable moment, Tony, as they like to say. Tony Wong, as always, thanks, and we'll keep updated on this. Thanks, Tony. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Have a great weekend. Take
Thanks,
care.
You too. Thanks, Tony. All right, so we'll see what happens, folks. He says one of the 11 is going to be masking in schools. There are 10 other points, executive orders, that the governor is going to tell the General Assembly, okay, you've got to vote to give me the power on this. Should be interesting.